Welcome back, True Crime Dimes. You might have deduced from its title and the fact that it's a true crime podcast that this show will cover potentially upsetting content. In addition to detailed accounts of all manner of horrific acts, this podcast will also entail the vital and varied use of curse words, BIPOC allyship, love for the LGBTQ plus community, using people's correct pronouns, and other pretty liberal shit. If any of that's gonna upset you, exit now. This is Trigger Warning, a true crime podcast. I'm your host, Jen O'Malley, and you've been warned. In the early 80s, a predator dubbed the Masked Rapist was terrorizing women in Northern Virginia. On June 27, 1983, a 23-year-old woman walking to her car after using a payphone was approached by a thin black man with his face covered. Using a long knife, he forced her into her car and made her drive about 15 minutes to an isolated area of the Green Valley neighborhood in Arlington. He had threatened to stab her the entire drive. The man searched her glove compartment for money, then marched the woman into the nearby woods and told her to remove her clothing. She refused, so he used his knife to slice open her blouse. She disrobed, he raped her twice, then told her to stay put because he was going to her car to get something and would be back. Once she realized that he was not going to return, she escaped. Just over 2 weeks later, a masked man broke into a different 23-year-old woman's apartment in Arlington. He had a 12-inch long serrated knife. He made the woman bring her purse to him and, after robbing her, forced her to perform oral sex on him. He then raped her. He had threatened to kill her the entire time. He then tried to abduct two more women, separately, but both escaped. However, on August 6th, he was once again successful when he forced a 22-year-old woman to drive her vehicle to a wooded area in Alexandria. He made her duct tape her own eyes, then raped her for over 2 hours. Afterward, he bound her hands behind her back, took her back to her car, and forced her into the trunk. Moments later, she smelled smoke. He'd set her car on fire. She was able to kick the trunk open and get out. A 27-year-old woman was abducted from her Arlington apartment laundry room on August 17th. The man had a knife, wore socks on his hands instead of gloves, and forced her back to her apartment, where he taped her mouth and tied her hands and feet with items found there. He then robbed and raped her. He told the woman, his only black victim, that he'd been looking for a white girl. This was followed by two more separate failed car abductions. On August 28th, a man entered a 29-year-old woman's Arlington apartment through an open window, duct taped her mouth, and raped her. He had cut the cords of her Venetian blinds. He then did almost the exact same thing to a 22-year-old Arlington woman on September 18th. He entered through an open window, cut the cords to her Venetian blinds, bound her hands and feet with them, then raped her with a toilet brush handle. On October 11th, the man forced a 45-year-old woman to drive to another remote location in Arlington where he raped and robbed her. He'd brought Vaseline as a lubricant. He then entered the apartment of a 24-year-old Arlington woman through an unlocked window on December 21st, where he robbed and raped her. He'd brought a dildo this time. In case you've lost track, that's 8 rapes and 12 attacks overall in 6 months. The police were aware that they were dealing with a serial rapist, but hadn't really alerted the public as they didn't want to cause a panic. And I just fucking cannot with that. On January 14th, 1984, a 22-year-old Chinese-American woman returned to her apartment to find the rapist waiting for her. He robbed her at knife point, but fled when he heard her roommate come home. He left behind a small flashlight. That same night, he attempted to abduct another woman in her car, but only got as far as stealing her purse before he was interrupted. The woman said he was wearing a homemade mask and a cream-colored Eisenhower jacket. On January 21st, a woman came home to discover that the rapist had been there, but apparently got tired of waiting for her. The cords of her Venetian blinds had been cut and were laid neatly on her bed, along with porn, carrots, and other things that had been stolen from the house next door. Carrots. That man had plans. Just 4 days later, and one block away, Carolyn Hom was found murdered in her South 23rd Street home. When the Washington attorney hadn't shown up for the second day in a row and had missed several appointments, her secretary called Carolyn's best friend, Darla Henry, and asked her to check on Carolyn. When Darla arrived at Carolyn's house, she noticed that the front door was open and snow had started to spread into the front hall. Carolyn's car was parked in the driveway, so Darla was immediately anxious. She spotted a young man, Larry Ranzer, backing out of a nearby driveway and called him over to help her investigate. The two entered Carolyn's home. They found her empty purse and all of its former contents at the bottom of the stairs, her workout clothes from Monday night on the upstairs bathroom floor, and her blue robe on the living room rug. Lengths of stereo wire and Venetian blind cords had been cut and draped neatly over a chair, but there was no sign of Carolyn. Darla and Larry headed to the basement. Someone had removed the dryer duct from the window, and it was freezing. A partially unrolled rug with a kitchen steak knife sitting on it was in the hallway that led to the garage. The heavy hemp rope tied around the rug had been cut. Continuing into the garage, Darla spotted Carolyn's body. She was naked, face down on the garage floor. Her wrists were tied behind her back with Venetian blind cords, and her bare feet were lying just inside the doorway to the basement. She'd been strangled with a noose formed from the hemp rope, and the loose end had been thrown over a water pipe and secured to the bumper of the inoperable vehicle in the garage, the pair called the police. That same day, while police were still working the scene at Carolyn's house, the man now known as the masked rapist broke into a house 6 blocks away. The 32-year-old homeowner heard a noise and went to investigate. She found the rapist, who shoved a knife toward her face and asked, "Okay, bitch, where's your purse?" After taking all her cash, he dumped what was left inside on the floor. He demanded that she disrobe, then handed her a dildo. Police would later learn that he'd stolen it from the house next door. She reported that when she refused to use it on herself, the rapist went nuts. He hit her in the face repeatedly, slashed her across the right calf, leaving a 4-inch scar, and forced her into the backyard where he made her perform oral sex on him while holding the knife to her eye. She screamed and he started slashing her up with the knife all over her legs and arms, but it saved her life. He jumped the fence and fled. Regarding Carolyn Holmes' murder, police initially suspected Larry Ranzer, the neighbor Darla had asked to enter the house with her. The day after his second interrogation, his sister called police to say that she had seen David Vasquez walking in front of Holmes' house on Monday night. David Vasquez had lived in that neighborhood, but moved 25 miles away to Manassas, Virginia with his mother more than 7 months earlier. For most of us, a 30-minute trip isn't that big of a deal, but David didn't drive. He was a 37-year-old man with an intellectual disability. David had an IQ of around 70 and functioned like a 10-year-old child. The day after Ranzer's sister called the police, a retired Army general, Michael Ansari, called police to tell them that he'd seen David in the neighborhood on the afternoon that Carolyn's body was discovered. Although there was no evidence, aside from these two calls, connected David to the crime, Arlington County Detectives Robert Carrig and Charles Shelton brought him in for questioning on February 4th. They began by asking David where he'd been at the time of the murder, and he insisted that he'd been in Manassas. They followed this up with a lie, telling him that they'd found his fingerprints at the murder scene. This just confused David, so he suggested that maybe he'd been there for a visit. So, they asked David how he'd gotten from Manassas to Carolyn's neighborhood, and he innocently replied that he'd like to know too, since he doesn't drive and his mom was at work. Bless. According to the National Registry of Exonerations, the interrogation went something like this. Asked what he had used to tie her hands, he first said the ropes, but Shelton told him it wasn't ropes. Vasquez then said he used his belt, but that was rejected. When he said, a coat hanger? Shelton said, no, it wasn't a coat hanger. Remember cutting the Venetian blind cord? Vasquez replied, it was thin rope. Shelton then asked Vasquez how he had killed Hom. I grabbed the knife and just stabbed her, that's all, said Vasquez. When Shelton said that was wrong and that he had hanged her, Vasquez said, okay, so I hung her. The brilliant detectives realized that they hadn't Mirandized David, so they interrogated him again on February 6th. David once again insisted that he hadn't been anywhere near Arlington the night Carolyn was killed. About 50 minutes into questioning, Detective Carrig left and took the tape recorder with him. According to Detective Shelton, a few minutes after Carrig left the room, David suddenly dropped his head to the table and blurted, I have horrible dreams. Shelton went and got the tape recorder, and David described a dream sequence that seemed to be about having consensual sex with Carolyn and hanging her at her request. David was arrested and charged with murder, rape, and burglary. The next day, he was interrogated once again, this time signing a Miranda waiver. As his trial day approached months later, David's lawyers tried to have all three of his statements suppressed as they weren't given voluntarily. The motion was granted for the first two interrogations, but the third was deemed admissible since David had waived his Miranda rights in writing. So, with the ridiculous dream sequence, confession, and two dubious eyewitnesses, Ranser, because she waited until her brother had been questioned multiple times as a suspect before coming forward, and Ansari's because no one else had reported seeing David in the area on the day of the murder, and despite the fact that the string of rapes in the area had all been committed by a black man, not a Hispanic man, and neither blood nor shoe prints left at the murder scene matched David, Commonwealth attorney Henry Hudson decided to move forward with prosecution. Because sure, why not? Somehow plea negotiations were introduced, and David's lawyers, fearing that the horrid nature of Carolyn's murder might sway a jury and conviction would probably mean a death sentence, advised him to enter an Alford plea on February 3, 1985, just one day before his trial was scheduled to start. David was sentenced to 35 years, and as a part of the deal, the judge recommended that the Department of Corrections place Vasquez in a facility in which he can receive psychiatric treatment. Despite his intellectual impairment and the judge's recommendation, due to the nature of the crime, David was sent to Buckingham Correctional Center in Dilwyn, Virginia, about 70 miles west of Richmond. According to the Washington Post, 80% of Buckingham's inmates are hardcore criminals requiring maximum security. Buckingham failed to classify David properly for his protection and, as you can imagine, at 5 feet 8 inches tall, 140 pounds, and docile, David did not fare well. Almost immediately, he was sexually assaulted, and it just kept happening. He was so traumatized that he became physically ill, suffering from vomiting, nervousness, agitation, and insomnia. He'd skip meals to avoid having to walk through the yard, and other inmates would steal the bags of snacks that his mama brought him. He was able to make friends with inmates and guards who'd do their best to protect him. Finally, 2 years in, he got a cell by himself. If all of this sounds completely unjust and horribly wrong to you, you're right. Come back next week to find out how David Vasquez became the first person in the United States to be exonerated by exculpatory DNA evidence. That's it for today, y'all. These first few weeks are super important for a new podcast. So if you enjoyed this episode, please follow the show. Share it with a friend. Leave a 5-star rating or review. Follow me on Instagram at @twtcpodcast. Become a patron. The link is in the show notes and in my Instagram bio. If a monthly commitment isn't your thing, you can Venmo me. It's, you guessed it, twtcpodcast. I want to shout out my second Patreon supporter, Shantae. I've known this incredible woman for about 11 years now, and there's nothing she can't do, y'all. She's proven time and again that she's unstoppable. Don't forget to check out my story highlight over on Instagram to enter the launch giveaway. Thank you so, so much for listening once again. Check out images related to this episode over on Instagram and come back next week to discover how David's set free.